Where are you from?
Originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Where are you living now?
Massachusetts.
Whereabouts?
West Hatfield.
Where's that?
Are you familiar with the area? I mean, you know western Massachusetts? Springfield?
I
Northampton?
Near Springfield?
Yeah, I live near about 5 miles from Smith College. Mm-hmm. In what's called the Five College area. Smith, Amherst, Mount Holyoke, UMass, and Hampshire.
How do you feel living up there with all those Yankees?
I've been there for 17 years. I'm at home.
Now you're a Yankee yourself now, huh?
In spirit, but I'm afraid my voice hasn't lost its hill.
You are a full-time illustrator?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you get into this line of work?
Well, I taught school for 20 years, and I am a painter by training, that is, university training, a painter. Then became a printmaker and got into wood engraving. And wood engraving is a medium which was invented in the late part of the 18th century to illustrate books alongside type. So my interest in woodblock, the art of woodblocks, led me into books. And I do more than illustrate a book. And that's a difference between the work that I do and the work of other illustrators. I control the book from the very beginning. It's a single idea controlled by a single mind. I am to a book the same thing that a sculptor is to a block of stone or a lump of clay or to wax or whatever a painter is to a canvas. The idea of the book is mine. I decide that I'm going to do Huckleberry Finn. I'm going to do Frankenstein or Alice, whatever. Then I decide on the design of the book, how big it's going to be, what the margins are. I decide what typeface is going to be used, how it's going to be styled. All of that stuff is done before I ever sit around to making pictures. And doing the images for a book is the very last thing that's done.
So you actually design the book?
Oh, I design it and produce it. We print the book in my studio, too. You know, we print a 600-page book, which is not the book that you have in front of you. The book you have in front of you is an offset edition of my edition. My edition is 13 inches high.
This is the $1,500.
It's a $1,000 edition.
The Penny Royal Press, is that your press?
That's my press, right. That's in West Hatfield.
I did, a friend of mine has a copy of the Mary Shelley book that you did.
Oh, yeah, Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Did you also do a limited of that one?
Yes.
You do limiteds of all of the books?
We do the limited edition first, 350 copies, and then we sell the rights to that to a secondary publisher. Heretofore, it has always been University of California Press. We work with Cal primarily because they're I think that the most interesting publishing in this country, anyway, today is done at the university press level, especially with the big ones like California, which is no small press by any stretch of the imagination. They produce, 300 titles a year, Harvard, Chicago, places like that. But they care so much about the production of a book. And my relationship with their production people is very good, and I'm always in on decisions. Any decision that affects the way that book looks has to go through me. And I'm not really sure that some of the so-called larger houses, commercial houses, would allow me to do that.
You did a 300-copy edition of Huckleberry Finn.
Right.
That was the Penny Royal Press
edition. That's the Penny Royal Press edition.
And that's available from you.
That's right.
Directly from you.
Directly from me.
The University of California Press edition. Now, did they design it, or did you have a hand in it?
No, it's the same all the way through, except the margins are different. And I worked with the designer in re-margining the book. They wanted to make this a companion piece on the shelf with Moby Dick, which I also illustrated in 1978, so that when they sit on the shelf together, they're the same size. So the margins are considerably different. And the book is a very different look, too.
They did a beautiful job. I haven't seen the limited edition, but going through this one. Now this is beautifully done. Now here's the weight, you can tell that this was good quality stuff. And
here's
a cloth bound book. I'm going to use the just partially covered in cloth. It's fully cloth.
Right.
I'm not sure what kind of paper was used, but I have a feeling that this is the kind of paper that is not going to turn yellow next year?
Not next year. No, it'll be at least 50 to 70 years before it yellows. So it's not a true archival sheet, and I frankly don't know what that book is printed on. My book is printed on archival paper. It will never yellow. It has no acids in it at all. It's all rag fibers and so forth. We're very particular about that. You build $1,000 books, you don't want them to fall apart.
No. Of the books that you have designed at the Penny Royal Press, the paper quality, where do you get this paper? Is it made for you?
Or? Well, Strathmore Paper Company has made paper to my specifications with my watermarks and that sort of thing. We have had paper handmade in India for us with our watermarks. We have come to the conclusion now, though, that we have decided now that from here on out we're using one specific paper manufactured in Cohoes, New York, by the Mohawk Paper Mills, and it's a paper that is made especially for letterpress printing. Has very little sizing in it. It's a beautiful sheet. Takes the ink marvelously well. And there's just no real reason to go looking for any other.
Now, this is rag paper.
It's cotton, yeah. Yeah, 100%. When you say rag, you start getting into technical things. It's not actually made from rags. A lot of paper is. The very best paper is made from rags. And that gets into whether it's knitted fabrics that it's made or whether it's woven fabrics. Because if it's made with knitted fabrics, you get all the fibers have hooks on them. That makes a stronger paper than fabrics that are just simply woven. Paper today, the paper that these books are printed on, are made from cotton linters, which is not fabric at all, but it is cotton. And then those are broken down into a pulp, you know, with water and size and so forth.
The fact that the base product for this paper, cloth in some form, does that mean that this is completely acid-free?
Yes.
That it cannot deteriorate?
That's right. Completely. It'll be here until Armageddon.
It'll last our lifetime.
Yes.
Anyways, that could happen next year, of course.
Yeah.
Now, you have your own press.
That's right.
You have a studio? Tell me a little bit about what it looks like.
Well, it's like a compound, if you can imagine, in western Massachusetts. We have a house where my three daughters and I live and where my studio is, which was built in 1846. It's an old New England farmhouse. We have adjacent to that two barns, one of which is presently standing empty. We're planning on expanding into that space. And then the other barn is where our presses are. So if you can imagine two structures that are 10 feet apart, but indeed two separate structures. And one is the domestic life of laundry and cooking and my studio, and which is not altogether separated, those three things. And then the other place is where the business is conducted. You know, my business manager and his secretary and the pressman, my other partner, who does all the production work. And we have five printing presses that are as big as this studio. Well, one of them is as big as this studio. And we print books.
So, will you print more than the limited editions, I would assume?
No, that's all we do now. We used to do it. We used to take in work. We'd do stationery and stag party cards, anything that anybody wanted printed, we'd print. But if we were hungry, needed the business. But a few years ago, we found out that was not, I don't know the fiduciary term for that. It wasn't financially advisable to do. Because we were spending, most of our headaches came from work that was earning only a fraction of our income, so we just decided not to do it and concentrate on doing our own limited edition books.
All of the material that you print with your five presses is your own material.
That's right. It's my own material.
If somebody were to say to you, Barry, I have a great idea for a book in a limited edition, will you print it for me? Would you consider that?
Yes. Yes, indeed, we do. In fact, we have right now, just in the last month, obtained the rights to W.B. Yeats' first play, which has never been published before. And we're going to do that. And that was a man in Amherst, Massachusetts, who called me and said, I have this manuscript and permission to use it. Would you be interested in illustrating it? The answer is, of course. Now, if someone came to me and said, I have this autobiography with my own drawings, and the autobiography was frankly awful, and the drawings were awful, I wouldn't even entertain it. They were not a vanity press in any sense. I, you know, we're in We're in the business, first of all, to produce beautiful books. And the second place, then, in order to produce beautiful books, you have to be able to make an income in order to do them. You know, unit cost on the books that we do, generally speaking, will run about $400 a book. That's what it costs us to build them. And then you figure, you know, your selling price then has to reflect the commissions taken by book dealers and all that sort of thing. So,
well, how do you market a $1,500 book? How do you go about letting people know about it?
Well, we have our own mailing list, and we have certain institutions. The New York Public Library has a standing order. They take everything we do. One copy of everything we do goes to the NYPL. And we have a lot of those. And so we will move out, of the 350 copies, we will move out 175 to 200 of those copies immediately. And then we will, then we'll have the others that will stay in inventory for a while, and then they'll trickle out. In the case with Alice in Wonderland, for instance, that book was sold out before we were off press. And we're beginning work on The Wizard of Oz, and we've already sold a lot of those, and we haven't even begun the work on it. Well, the work has begun, but we're not anywhere near to marketing it yet. So that book, I'm sure, will be sold out before we're off press. But there are collectors of rare books. You know, people whose names you would certainly know, who collect expensive, rare, fine books, finely made books. I mean, you're talking about in this, you're talking about the same kind of clientele who buys paintings. We're talking about books that are made in the very best manner that a book can be made, some object of art.
How many books of this type do you print a year?
Two.
Only two?
Two. Mm-hmm. This year, well, two of this size, this scale. This year it's Huckleberry Finn and The Wizard of Oz. But in between that, I will have done five or six other small books, in which they're, by small books, I mean they're 6 by 9 inches and might have three illustrations, or I'll take a commission from Time Life or somebody like that, and I'll do other work. But the press is pretty well tied up just doing two books a year.
Now, the books that you publish is limited. So are they all 350 or 300 copies? Or
yeah.
What is the actual number?
350.
350.
Yeah, 300 are for sale, 50 are reserved for people who are involved in the project.
Now, is there always a tie-in with the University of California Press?
Not written in stone, but everything that we have done so far, the University of California has picked up and marketed. Now, one of the things that's different between that my press is unique in is the addition to merely new typography, new presentation, new illustrations. We also try to make some new scholarly contribution. In the case of Frankenstein, it was working with Joyce Carol Oates and her introduction. Also going back to the 1818 text, which had only been reprinted by the University of Chicago Press. It's a very difficult text to find because most of the Frankenstein is out of the 1832 editions. In Alice, we did a full annotation, you know, with one of the finest Victorian scholars in America and that sort of thing. So the scholarly aspect of my books is of great interest to the University of California.
What are some of the other books that you have come out with over the last, how many years have you been doing this
thing? I did my first wood engraving in 1968, and I did my first book in 1970. So in 14 years I've done, if you consider book jackets and frontispieces for books and things like that, I've done over 70, 75, 80 books, something in there.
What are some of the recent titles?
Most of the classics. The Divine Comedy, which was just reviewed a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times. We just finished that. That was a 5-year-long project, all three volumes. Of course, Huckleberry Finn, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass, The Hunting of the Snark, The Aeneid, those are all with the University of California, and Moby Dick. But Moby Dick was not a Pennyroyal book. That was published by somebody in San Francisco, but I illustrated it. Beyond that, I've done books like The Odyssey and most of the classics. And then right now working on The Wizard of Oz.
The woodcut illustrations in Huckleberry Finn are absolutely beautiful. Wood engraving, is that the way to pronounce it?
Wood engraving,
right.
Mm-hmm. Wood engraving. Mm-hmm.
Was that the first means of illustrating a book?
No. Books have been illustrated. Well, I started to say no. But yes, I think that's probably true, because the first books were printed were what were called block books, and they were where the words and pictures were cut into a block of wood and printed so that the text and everything's on one piece of wood. Then came the invention of movable type, and a movable type was an invention of an Oriental invention, China. And they were made originally in ceramic, but then they started making them in wood, and then, of course, finally Gutenberg casting them in metal. But wood engraving was not invented, actually, until the 18th century. So it's a relative, it's right in with lithography as being one of the youngest of the printmaking media. The difference is that wood cuts are done on the plank grain. If you can imagine a big solid oak door, a wood cut would be drawn and cut on the face of the door. The wood engraving would be drawn and cut on the top of the door, on the end grain, not on the side grain. So that the cutting tools no sense of direction of grain. They're not impeded in any way by the wood. And that's why you look at the engravings, they're so clean and dense.
Well, are we talking about two different things? We're talking about wood cuts and wood engravings.
Wood cuts are on the side grain of wood, and wood engravings are done in the end grain of wood. And it makes two very different media. And this is very visual.
Now, wait a minute, what have you done here?
That's on end grain wood.
So this is a wood cut.
That's a wood engraving.
It's on the
plank.
We don't have wood in
here. Right. If you did it on this,
yeah.
Well, that side, this. If you took this right here and cut it in two and drew on this end of it, okay, the tree's growing this way. If you draw it across, you imagine cutting it off, a pancake of wood out of a trunk, and you make the print on that end grain, that's a wood engraving. If you take a plank out of the tree and you do it on the side of it, that's a wood cut. And you have all kinds of play of grain. And I'm reminded of Edvard Munch and his great wood cuts.
So the wood engraving, then, you have more control over
much
what
more
you
control.
Want to do.
Right. And it's a much more refined technique. And it works beautifully with printing, because the blocks are the same height this time.
Now, how big a piece of wood or block of wood do you use approximately for these engravings?
7x9, 8x10, something like that, and that's a big wood engraving.
You must use special wood engraving tools.
Right, yeah. Well, they're the engraving tools are the same tools that are used by metal engravers. They're just tempered differently. But it's not an open gouge. It's a solid shaft of steel that pushes wood out in front of it like a pigtail, what they call a burr. But it doesn't scoop it out.
My intention, of course, was talking about Huckleberry Finn, but this is absolutely fascinating. I have more to this story than I thought. I want to talk about Huckleberry Finn in a moment, but I want to go back to the presses. You see, you have five presses.
Right.
Are these hand-set type presses, or what?
Yes.
What are they like?
They're letterpress machines. We have two vertical presses, we have two cylinder presses. Now, the vertical presses, the type is locked up into a steel chase, which is just a rectangle of steel, locked in with expanding units, which are called coins, Q-U-O-I-N-S, which are just held in by pressure, that's all, and a great deal of pressure, but they're held in place. Vertical press, that chase is put in vertically so that the type is perpendicular to the floor. The cylinder and the rollers come up over it, ink it, and the platen, which carries the paper, comes up and meets it like a clamshell. And if your listening audience knows printing equipment, and I just said clamshell, they think I'm talking about a clamshell press, but it's not. But at any rate, that's basically what happens. You have this thing that closes. The cylinder presses, the type is standing up. It's parallel to the floor rather than being a right angle to the floor. And the cylinder of the press comes, the bed of the press goes underneath the cylinder. When it goes under the cylinder and gets its ink, it comes back out. The cylinder drops down and rolls over it with the paper and imprints it. Very slow, inefficient techniques of printing. Now, we print 500 impressions an hour. And if you go to big houses, big printing houses, it's thousands of impressions an hour. And in web printing, it's thousands of impressions a minute.
What about the typefaces?
Well, those are the typefaces that we use, generally speaking, are very traditional. I'm a traditionalist in many, many ways. I'm also an iconoclast, which makes for interesting stuff happening. But we use monotype type, for the most part, for printing our books, which is a manner of casting metal one letter at a time. Then you can use linotype, which is a manner of casting out a whole line of type, hence its name, line of type, linotype. But it's on one slug. We don't use linotype because it has a lot of inherent problems. You can't get the same kind of beauty of impression with linotype you can with monotype. And then, of course, there's hand setting, where you actually put in each letter of every word, of every paragraph, of every page by hand. And we do that on small books, but on a 600-page book, it's not cost-effective. That was the word I was looking for.
Mm, yeah.
Yes, and our books are... The market for my books is for the illustrations, and we just don't think that it's worth our time to hand-set something like that.
Makes me feel guilty. I have a Macintosh computer at home.
we have one in
our
office.
Of the computer, which is... which I thought was a wonderful advance, because in the past we had taken scissors and paste and things like that,
and
using IBM typewriters that I would type the columns and stick them in and all of that, and then with this Macintosh, you know, it's incredible. I can't believe it. I'm sitting there typing and watching it come out on the screen and
make your corrections.
Make the correction and
it justifies it.
Yeah, and then at the end, it looks like it came from a computer, but. The average person wouldn't even bother to notice.
Right, right.
Because you're actually giving them information in a very nice way. But
well, Eric Gill said about typography that it was the art invisible. Yeah. And it is indeed. People come to my books and the first thing they go to are the pictures, which is the proper response, except that it's the... it's not a sophisticated response, because people will go by the cradle that the baby is sleeping in. They go right to the baby. And the cradle is the typography. You know, it's those margins. I sweat blood over whether that margin is going to be, you know, this wide or that wide, and which one's going to be heavier, where the page number is going to go, where the folios are going to be placed.
See, with the Macintosh, you don't have to worry about that.
That's right.
It'll reconcile. It'll give you your page numbers automatically.
Right, right.
And, type in the date and the time you printed it if you want.
Well, we have one. We have a computer in our office because it controls inventory and it bills and it writes checks and
Don't print any books on it, please.
But no books. It doesn't even come near the press room.
Well, you said that. One of the nice things that you can do, and this obviously reflects your independence, is to select the books that you like.
Right.
Obviously, you must have liked Huckleberry Finn.
Indeed, yeah. Now, I have to clarify something. The University of California came to me on Huckleberry Finn and said, would Huckleberry Finn be a book that you would be interested in doing as a limited edition, which we could then offset? And I said, yes. I then took Huckleberry Finn with me, and... thinking that I was going to reread Huck Finn, found out, as I think a lot of people do, I'd never read it.
Oh, you hadn't read it?
This was 4 years ago, 3 years ago, something like that. Yeah, Huckleberry Finn is the most read, unread book in America, someone said. I mean, more people think they've read this book, and then they come to it, and they've never read it. You know, people ask, they look at my pictures, and they'll say, where's Becky Thatcher? You know, Becky's not in Huck Finn. There's no whitewashed fence or anything. And people think that The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn is one book, you see. And so I took it along, being one of those people who thought that. And there's no Indian Joe or any of that sort of thing. And I was completely surprised. And then that was 3 years ago, and I study and, do an awful lot of work on the...
Huckleberry Finn's a lot different than Tom Sawyer, too.
Oh, it's indeed.
I had always looked upon Huckleberry Finn as an adult novel, and Tom Sawyer as a kid's book.
Children's adventure story, right.
But when I was a kid, I did read Huckleberry Finn, and when I was a kid, I did not reread it for this interview, but I have read it. And when I was a kid, there was this opening statement.
You don't know about me? Oh, the...
we have to go in for...
Yeah, there's an awful lot of formatting. The notice?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to read that. Persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished. Persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot.
by order of the author.
I read that. And I didn't know it was in jest.
Yeah.
I took it seriously, and it frightened me. And I said, should I take this book seriously? I mean, I don't know, you know. So that really threw me off, because I approached the book seriously, and I didn't understand that Mark Twain had this rather strange sense of humor.
I mean, he got galleys on his back, and someone had taken the word damn and taken out A-M-N and put in a dash. And he was infuriated, and he wrote a letter back saying, you know, something to the effect, if this doesn't get back in there, I'm going to take the editor and I'm going to shoot him before he has a chance to pray, you know.
Or he could have said, fug you.
Exactly. But, you know,
you did something in this book that was unusual. You have restored a part of a chapter that was excised.
Right.
Tell me about that.
All right. The University of California at Berkeley, the Bancroft Library, is the repository for most of Mark Twain's papers. It's the Mark Twain, it's in fact called the Mark Twain Papers. And within that is the Mark Twain Project, which is an ongoing project to restore all of Mark Twain's writings to their original form. As you well know, books always undergo various kinds of corruption in the process of production. Editing, well, first of all, the author's own mistakes. Then in the editing process, then in the typesetting process, then in the proofreading process, and then in the correction of the proofs, all kinds of things will happen. People will proofread, and of course Mark Twain's writing this book in 5 dialects, and he will spell the word ain't 3 different ways. Or he'll spell the word, you know, some other word 4 different ways. So that people would come back in, proofreaders, trying to help Mr. Twain out and do all of this. Now, this text has been edited. It took 7 years to edit the text and get all the commas back in their right place, get all the semicolons back in the right place, and get all the dialect back in its right order. Now, amidst all of that, in the middle of the 7 years that it took Twain to write the book, he hit a very dry point, didn't know what to do with what he had done. And he didn't write anything for a while. And during that period of time, his publisher took a section of the book, which would stand on its own as a short story, and published it in a magazine. And it was called The Raft, I think, or something like that. Well, when he did finish the book in 85, he wanted to restore that. He wanted to put that raft, that so-called raft chapter, back into the book. But his editor said no, because it's already been published elsewhere. And also because if it's not there, the book will be shorter and make it more of a physical companion to Tom Sawyer sitting on the shelf. And so they left it out of the first edition, and it's been left out of every subsequent edition until now. And we've put it back in, after the Mark Twain Project, put it back into its original form.
These scholars, I assume it was more than one at the Mark Twain Project.
Yes, indeed.
Made sure that the new book is the definitive edition. Would you describe this as the definitive?
Yes, this is the definitive text for Huckleberry Finn. It's the first time that Huckleberry Finn can be read the way Mark Twain wrote it. First time ever.
Because Mark Twain got away with more than he could get away with today, especially in terms of writing style. We don't really use dialects in print. I mean, we might say so-and-so has a southern accent.
Right.
Or someone spoke in broken English. Mm-hmm. But rarely do writers get away with dialects in the way that Twain did. Matter of fact, a lot of old books that go back to the early part of the 20th century, late 19th century, a lot of the writers use dialects. And it's hard, not only is it hard to follow, sometimes they don't know how to phoneticize the dialects
exactly.
Very well,
yeah.
And they fall flat.
Joel Chandler Harris is a good example of that. I mean, his the Tales and Sayings of Uncle Remus, written entirely in dialect. And if you haven't been brought up in the culture to have an ear for that, it's impossible to read. It's like reading a foreign language.
Feel the same way about Robert Burns, the Scottish.
Oh yeah,
I can't
sure.
They make head or tail.
I feel the same way about Shakespeare myself. I mean,
Well, even muddled from Shakespeare a little bit. But, but Robert Burns, he's writing in, it's almost a different language.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't figure that out at all. Yeah. Are you worried at all now that you have your own Penny Royal Press edition and the definitive edition from the California University of California Press? Are you worried that because of recent criticism of Mark Twain being accused of being a racist and people saying that we've got to get Huckleberry Finn off the high school library shelves and all, are you worried that you're going to have some flack?
Not at all. I hope it sells books, you know, but... And no, I don't. I'm not expecting anything like that to happen. Most of the criticism of Huckleberry Finn, I hope I don't offend anyone by saying this, but if I do, then I need to be offended. But most of the offense to the book is taken by people who haven't read it. If they've read it, they don't understand it and haven't taken the time to see beyond the superficial. Mark Twain is simply portraying. And the book is full of portraits, and it's what I've done with the book. I approach it from the point of view of portraiture. Almost every illustration in the book is a portrait of someone. It's not a full figure study. It's a character study of a face. That's it. And essentially, that's what Twain has done, are portraits of people. And I dare say that Pat Finn is a bleeding racist of the worst sort. And so is the King and the Duke, and so is Miss Watson, and all these people. And indeed, so is Huck at the beginning. But that doesn't make Mark Twain himself a racist. He is an artist who is painting a portrait of a racist. How can he paint a portrait of a racist and put nice words in his mouth? And it can't be done. You have to use the ugliness to portray ugliness. You can't, you know. So the objection to the book on the grounds of its being racist, I think, are ill-founded. And I think most black writers, I'm thinking of Ishmael Reed, for instance, who lives in Berkeley and who recently said that, you know, it's the best book ever written by a white man in America. You know, this is one of our foremost black poets who is saying this. You know, most black writers, I think, would agree with me. The book, I would base it on two events, two central events. One, what he does with Huck, Huck's shift, and the whole dilemma, the crisis of the book comes when Huck is alone. He's going to be instrumental, or he's not going to be instrumental, in freeing Jim, helping him escape. That's his dilemma. The upbringing that he has had, and God knows I understand this because I was brought up the same way in a Southern racist family. The upbringing that he's had leads him to conclude that if he helps this man escape, that the act of doing that is going to doom him to perdition. It's going to doom him to hell, fire, and damnation. But he knows in his heart, in his true heart, he knows that he has to. And he sacrifices himself knowingly to hellfire and damnation for doing what he thinks is right for a black man. That's not a racist attitude. The second thing is at the end of the book, most people don't get to the end of the book, or people who do think that Twain gave up at the end and just, you know, shot the bull and it's a sort of a false ending or something. I don't think so at all. What happens at the end is Tom Sawyer makes his appearance, and he's a slick little guy, and he comes in full well knowing that Jim is a free man. He's bringing the news that Jim is a free man, but he's going to have a little fun before he tells him, and so he perpetrates this thing and puts Jim in prison, and they go through all of this Walter Scott sort of escape routine and all that business. Then finally, when they do escape, when they break him out and they go running across the woods at night and Tom gets shot, they get to an island. Huck goes back to fetch a doctor. Jim stays with Tom Sawyer. The doctor comes to the island. Huck is kept home. Doctor comes to the island. Jim stays and helps him care for Tom, and in fact the doctor and Jim bring Tom back to the Phelps farm. The rednecks there take Jim and throw him in chains and ridicule him and threaten to whip him and all sorts of things. They're racists. The doctor steps in and says, stop. This man had two opportunities to escape, and he chose neither time to escape. He chose rather to stay. In fact, now these are my words, he chose to stay with his tormentor. Now there's a great deal of nobility in that. That's not the act of a slave. That's not an act of a stereotypical Southern black, as people, another criticism is that, that Jim's a stereotype. He's not a stereotype. There's such an act of nobility there, which then puts Huck and Jim right in the same category as Natty Bumppo and his companion in the Deerslayer, and with Queequeg and Ishmael and Moby Dick. You have that noble other race, okay, and a white man who is of lower caste than the black man. And of course the doctor intercedes and Jim is set free, and Tom pipes up and says, you know, he is a free man.
Well, Barry Moser, you certainly have made up for your childhood lapse in not reading Huckleberry Finn. You've done triple duty in looking at the book and thinking about it and analyzing it and doing these beautiful, beautiful wood engravings. So it's quite an achievement, and as I said earlier, I thought we were going to be chatting about Mark Twain, but I learned a lot of new things about your work. So I'm going to do something on Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn. I'm going to do a separate piece, which is going to focus on your work and on the other books too, because there's so much information there that people like myself just don't know about. And there's a small way to reach a mass audience. I know there are book collectors who thrive on the kind of work you do, but these are rarities, and I think the vast majority of people don't. Well, when I first started doing BookBeat, I think there was which is been on for many, many years, but there was this automatic feeling, well, books, you know, only 1% right. of the entire adult population will buy a hardcover book in a year.
Right.
So we're really reaching a minority audience.
Yes.
But I feel that I can make a news story out of a book and out of an author and out of techniques. Today I'm doing a two-part series on the Reader's Digest, condensed books.
I heard some, yes. Yeah.
That's not off the wall.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
Yes,
they focus their books at a very different type of reader, a conservative,
yes.
religious-oriented,
right.
Midwestern type of reader who will not be afraid to.
I was fascinated out there in the waiting room listening to that. It was wonderful.
So I find I can dig a new story out of almost any book.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome. It's my
pleasure. It was really easy to talk to and fascinating at that. So thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome.